morning. The 9 a.m. Finance Committee meeting is called to order. Do we have a quorum here? No. Is that how we're ready?
I don't know. Okay.
We're ready.
Great.
The agenda is before us. Are there any objections to the agenda as printed? Hearing none, the agenda is accepted as provided. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
I have a change to the minutes, but I will approve it for the purposes of discussion.
Is there a motion?
So moved.
And a second?
Second.
Any other discussion, Mr. Benjamin?
Page 2, item D, last line. I presume that it should read fund.
They'll find it after they find it. They'll find it after they find it.
Yeah, we'll find it.
If we could,
I think it should be fund.
If we could make that change. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And there, if you note, H is different than listed, and it is a clarification of the discussion. I don't think I see anything substantive than I initially read. Any other discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. We have a full action item, and we're going to go through these where discussion is needed, but as quickly as possible. And the first item has been before us before, and it's the approval of the Center Bend Road Design Build Agreement and Financial Plan. And Mr. Kubicek is the presenter. Is there a motion to, well, let me ask Mr. Kubicek to quickly give us a one-liner as to what we're doing with this, since this is before us.
I'll have Mr. Thomas comment.
Okay. Mr. Thomas.
Good morning, Madam Chair. excuse me. We're here asking for approval for three items, to amend the master development agreement we have for Cinder Bed Road, approval for three new positions added to the capital budget, and extending the current property sales agreement for 120 days.
Okay. Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr. McKay.
Move approval.
Second.
Second. Any discussion?
I have a question that applies to this one and the next one. Okay. In both of them, capital positions are added to the budget. Between the two of them, 13 positions. What happens at the conclusion of this project? Are those positions so defined that they disappear when the project is no longer funded?
Yes.
I can answer that, yes. Actually, if you don't mind. They are capital-funded positions, and we actually distinguish them at HR as capital-funded positions. And the policy is that when the funds are extinguished, the project is complete, then the positions are then, go away, terminated. And that's made clear in the description.
So the people who are hired into these positions know that they run the life of the project, and before the end, they either have to find another project or they
yeah.
leave.
And typically, you know, when we have folks who do projects such as this, we actually like to keep them because of the skill set. You know, it reduces some of the recruitment that we have to do. So there's always another project that they can fulfill. So that's what we hope to do.
So it's being funded from this particular
right.
And they have no right to
right.
a job.
And I guess the other part is there a change in the budget of this, the funding that we're speaking of?
You know, there's no change in the budget due to these actions.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. The next item is the Orange Blue Line contract. This is part of the overall contract for the rail lines.
Okay. What you have before you is basically the next phase of major overhaul and rehab for the railroad. As you all know, presently we have the red line segment concept that's underway. And at this point in time, we're approaching you all with the next phase where we'll start looking at the orange and the blue line and the work that will be taking place for the next several years. In the interest of time, the PowerPoint, you know, is pretty detailed. We really tried to focus on a lot of areas that were customer-related, infrastructure-related. And if there's any specific questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay, and this is moving forward that contract and moving it into the orange line portions. That's the,
that's correct.
Is there a motion?
So moved.
Second.
And now discussion?
I have
question. Mr. Benjamin.
Two questions. One, you are reconstructing platforms in several places, and I remember a discussion before, which is much more significant these days since we have a board member who fell down on a platform. I thought we were replacing the tiles with stamped concrete, colored stamped concrete. Is that right or is that wrong?
Yes, we do. We're using like a paver-type product that we have up at Tacoma Station, and that's the process in which we're going forward. For
so
example,
the pavers, they're not really stamped concrete?
Yeah, but, I mean, they have a very, very tough aggregate, you know, for adhesion. So Rockville, that's, for example, that's our first major project that we have undertaken, and it provides a great example of what's taking place to these stations going forward.
And they look very much like the existing tiles?
Yes, sir.
Okay. The other question was, in this, in two places, I thought I found replacement of escalators. And I know that in the past, that's not been what we've done. We've rebuilt because our experience has not been good. Are we now getting a better experience on replacing? And do we have somebody who builds good escalators?
I'll take care of that.
I'll let Mr. Kibble take this.
What we have over in Pentagon, we're replacing those three units, which are APV Baker units that were installed some time ago when we did that area. So we're taking those out that are very poor performers in that and putting in a unit that is more like the ones that we have now that we're rebuilding.
So there is somebody who provides that unit that we can, in fact, get in that location?
Yes.
Because in many locations, I know we can't get it in.
You're exactly right.
Yeah. Okay. So we have some where we in fact, can do some replacement.
Just those three.
Is it possible in other places throughout the system, and would it make more sense in some cases, or is this?
No, just this is isolated.
Okay.
That may have been a notice for us to remember to speak into the mic. So, if we remember to do that. Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes.
Following on that question by Mr. Benjamin, you know, what is our policy on rehab versus replacement? I mean, some of these escalators are, what, 20, 30 years old. I mean, what is the general philosophy and policy you use and parameters you use and metrics you use to determine whether you rehab versus replace?
Okay. As we go through this rehab project and or, you know, direct replacement, a lot of it depends on the current status of the mega infrastructure of the escalator. It's not necessarily an item that it really wears. It's kind of like a frame of the unit. And so what we've really focused on is all of the moving compartments or moving components that's inside the unit, wearable items. And then also the other area that we're focused on is the overall controls, sensitivity, how the motor starts or how the escalator starts or how it shuts down. But most of the time your superstructure is relatively very, very stable for a long, long period of time.
So in essence, the rehab actually is a replacement of all the major
pretty much
pieces,
I mean,
of the system.
Yeah, whenever you stand on the escalator, pretty much all of those components and stuff are being replaced. And if you look at some of our rehabs, you'll see some of the structure and stuff off to the side that's bolted in place. Naturally, that is, you know, reviewed to make sure that it's still within tolerance. But it's pretty close to a total replacement.
Another part of that question is, certainly in the red line that I primarily use, there's a lot of uncovered escalators that are open to the weather and elements. Are we running into that in this rehab, and are we addressing trying to at least provide some sort of shelter or cover to prevent the escalator from getting undue, let's say, wear from the weather conditions?
Yeah, that's a line item in our capital project, in our program. Naturally, that's discussed on a regular basis, and if we do, a lot of times, if we do like major rehabs, depending upon the jurisdiction, in some places it's actually required that we do cover it, you know, aesthetically.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Brown.
In a large contract like this, which has all kinds of componentry in it, are we able to really specify what we want in the way of an escalator or other component?
I would say that
what the main contractor develops as his little bit.
Yeah. I would say what we've really focused on is maybe not necessarily the overall name brand, because as you know, there's a high turnover and volume. What we install there might not be here 10 years from now, as you've seen in previous presentations. But what we're really focused on is the technology, motor controls, the mechanical side, because those are really the staples of the unit itself. And if we go in with an inferior platform, for example, we're looking at an industrial grade versus more of a mall-type environment on some of the escalators that were looked at. So we are very critical of our standards and the criteria in which we are putting these things together. And that's put in the spec.
We can look at what he proposes to do and approve it or not approve it.
There you go. Absolutely.
Question.
Okay.
I, in a later item in another committee where we talk about the elevator escalator assessment. There's a finding in here about water intrusion in machine rooms, hoistways, and pit areas is one of the problems that's been identified. Is that at all being addressed in this rehab, and how so?
Yes, we are. We've incorporated that whenever we're going into these stations. Again, that's the advantage of this line segment approach in uncertain areas. Is that way when we're tearing up tile or tearing up conduit and everything else, that we can start addressing those things all at the same time instead of piecemealing our approaches, which drives up our expenses and time.
So is it fair to say that the items that are in the audit report as systemic difficulties are being corrected in this rehabilitation?
Yes, there will be a, what we're doing, we're going to prioritize our repairs because, as you know, on this line segment contract, it's several years. There are certain areas that we don't have time to wait.
Right.
So we're going to have to pick the areas that we know that are causing us a lot of problems, and we're going to jump on top of those right now, and we're going to try to mobilize as many locations as we can.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. So this moves forward the contract, our capital improvement contract that's in place for the specific lines designated. Is there one more question?
Have we advertised and taken bids yet, or will that be the next step? These are solid numbers.
Yeah, these are solid numbers.
Bids?
Pardon?
How good were the bids?
Can you introduce yourself, please?
Can you introduce yourself, please?
Okay. I'm sorry. My name is Lou Viner, and I'm the acting director for IRPG. We actually had a two-step process. The first step, we got five proposers, and four of those proposers were qualified. Actually, all five of them were qualified, but we told them we'd only take four. We proceeded with the four. The four provided their proposals. Actually, the proposals, the winning proposal that we got was under our budget. So,
I mean, that's happening all around. We should be taking advantage of it.
We did get a very competitive set of proposals.
Thank you.
Hearing no other questions, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And opposed? Thank you, and this is a very good item. We can see it quickly move forward. The next item is the acceptance of the audit financial statement deliverables, and Ms. Liu, here.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Helen Liu. I'm the Inspector General. Sitting next to me is Michael Stevens, a partner with our external auditors, Clifton Gunderson. We are here today to request the committee's acceptance of the fiscal year 2010 financial statement audit deliverables. Specifically, they are the audited financial statements and the two single audit reports. Mike will then go through and provide you the findings.
Good morning. As Ms. Liu said, my name is Mike Stevens. I'm a partner with Clifton Gunderson. In the interest of time, I'll move to the audit results, which is part of your package here. We're completed the audit. We expect to issue an unqualified opinion, which is what you want. It basically says the statements are in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. That's consistent with the prior year opinions. As a result of the audit, we're also required to test internal controls and compliance in accordance with the single audit. With respect to internal controls, we did have four findings, three of which relate to IT issues, access controls, change controls, and some documentation related to existing systems that are subsequently going to be replaced. And then there was also four findings on compliance issues. And those compliance issues relate to contract compliance for federal contracts in excess of $2,000 as they relate to certain requirements of the contractor. Again, contract-related documentation of suspension and debarment, unauthorized access to bus facilities as required by FTA requirements, and charter bus reporting as required, again, by FTA. Also, there were no audit adjustments or past adjustments with respect to the audit, and as I said, it will result in an unqualified opinion. And they're the overall results of the audit.
Okay. So the audit sees no challenges in terms of financial accountability, cash flow, and those, but those other material and other things were listed. I guess I'd have one, like for you to start in responding in this as well. On the repeat item, would you distinguish what has happened from the time of his first lap from the last audit and now?
Is that with respect to the capital asset reported?
Yes.
You all have a capital asset system where you record the cost and associated depreciation, so on, of all your fixed assets throughout the authority. It's rather extensive. That system is dated and has various reconciliation and reporting issues. There is a project underway to replace that system, but it is not to be implemented, I believe, until 2011. And as such, management has made the decision to, for lack of a better term, nurse the system until the new system is implemented from a cost-benefit standpoint. We're obligated to make the comment from a professional standards reporting standpoint, so it is a repeat comment from prior years, but there is a corrective action in place. It just wasn't effective as of this reporting period.
Yes.
Just one adjustment, I apologize, but and that's exactly right. The system is actually going to be implemented by this December, not in January 2011. So we had made the decision to, and this is part of the integrated finance project, PeopleSoft upgrade that we're doing. So.
All right. Are there other questions from the board members? Because I would think there are several.
Yes. Actually, I wanted to move the item and also is there a second?
Second.
And also two things. One, comment on the fact that Mr. Stevens did about as quick and effective a presentation as I think I've seen any auditor ever do. Thank you, sir. That was well done. And very carefully throughout all of this documentation, it says that we are accepting the audit. We're not approving it, except in the BAIS recommendation, where it says approval. So before this gets to the board, this is not your stuff, Mr. Stevens. It is the staff activity. And that recommendation, if we could change that to accept instead of approve, I would appreciate it.
Yeah. I think that's what you're doing.
Yes.
Yes. Don't tell me that. Any other questions about the items? Okay. And I guess one point that we want to make about some of these is that those items that are considered deficiencies are have a working plan, and I guess we, the board, will see that progress report in terms of that. And yes.
Yes, we will follow up on the corrective action plan that the authority provides.
Mr. Downey.
Comment that this was reviewed and discussed at length at the audit committee. It's gotten a lot of attention.
Can I add one other thing? Just to give some context for the board, but in last year's financial statements and audit that Gunderson provided for us, we actually had 9 significant deficiencies. And so the progress, just to give you a sense of the progress, we have now, cleared those with corrective action measures, and now we have 3 others that are not as significant, and we can provide the corrective action measures this year. So just to give you some context for the board, I think that's important.
And if I may add, along those same lines, the standard setters are always changing that definition of significant deficiency and so on, requiring us to report more and more. So the fact that the number of comments was reduced is significant. So.
Thank you for the report. All those in favor? And this is accepting.
Aye.
And second, I'm sorry, opposed? None. Okay. This is approved. Our next item, 2 items actually have to do with the Metropolitan Police and grant. The National Explosive Detection K-9 Team Grant. Chief Paul Kedorn.
Good morning, Madam Chair, other members of this committee, and members of the WMATA Board. Today I come with you to ask and seek ratification to the Transportation Security Administration's National Transportation K-9 Program grant fund. The Metro Transit Police has been the recipient of previously awarded grants through the Transportation Security Administration in 2005. The board at that time approved MEAD 99512 on May 19, 2006. The grant was for a period of 5 years, and this particular grant is a continuation of the National Explosive Detections Team program and will cover a duration of 5 years. We ask that the grant will reimburse the authority a total of $40,000 per K-9 team for a total of $200,000 on an annual basis. Next slide. I ask that you ratify the Transportation Security Administration's National Explosive Detection K-9 Team Program grant for $1.02 million covering the next 5 years through October 1st, 2015.
Thank you, Ms. Hewlett, and thank you, Mr. McKay. Any other questions regarding this? This is a continuation of a grant, and there's a clarification regarding should there be a change in terms of the latter years regarding the transfer or return to federal government if we don't continue this beyond funding that piece. All those in favor?
Before you do that,
yes.
I have one question. Is this going to get us more visible officers on platforms, in the buses, and in the rail vehicles?
Well, it's a continuation of the current officers that we have that are deployed for protection. So those same, it's not an additional five officers, although it's just the payment for the resources, the training, the materials, the veterinary care, those things for the existing five officers.
Okay, so it is not going to help us at all in the fact that at least my perception, I think that of many others, is that there's not great visibility of our police within our systems.
It will also work to help that. We travel, again, over 1,500 square miles working with all three jurisdictions, and we do the best that we possibly can do with regards to visibility. But it will not add an additional police officers, no.
The second piece of that, of course, is if we don't ratify this, we're taking five police officers off. So, you know, while we're not gaining, we would be losing if we didn't ratify this, correct?
Correct, sir. Okay.
Any other questions? All those in favor?
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Tabor. And the next one is a similar but different area, and this is bus security. And this one is of importance, and we're talking about a use of transfer of funding from a program and moving forward to secure our bus facilities.
Yes, Madam Chair. The Metro Transit Police is seeking the approval to hire 17 additional special police officers to ensure security at all 8 WMATA bus divisions. As we all recall, a local resident, Mr. William Jackson, acquired a bus from the Bladensburg Bus Division and drove a B2 route, picking passengers up along the way. Mr. Jackson eventually crashed into a tree and fled the bus on foot. Through the efforts of residents of the District of Columbia and the Metropolitan Police Department, Mr. Jackson was arrested without incident. Mr. Jackson has pled guilty to unauthorized use of a motor vehicle and is scheduled for sentencing on November 8th. 2010. Next slide. The 17 additional officers will provide coverage at all 8 Metro bus divisions and overall will improve the safety and security of those bus divisions. The annual cost of the 17 additional officers is approximately $900,000. However, we anticipate spending $525,000 in FY11 as we are 4 months into the fiscal year, and we anticipate it will take about 1 month to bring the 17 new hires on board. Currently, the members of the Metro Transit Police Department is providing security coverage at 3 bus divisions, Royal Street, Northern Division, and Montgomery County, Montgomery Division. If the hiring of the 17 additional special police officers is approved, that then the Metro Transit Police will be relieved of the overtime responsibilities for those locations. Next slide. It is the recommendations to hire the 17 additional special police officers to provide security coverage, again, at all 8 divisions, and to alleviate the MTP of the overtime burden currently being incurred.
Question. Okay. Mr. McKay, go ahead.
Yeah. Can you define what a special police officer is? How is that different than a regular sworn police officer? Okay. Or is it?
It's different. The Metro Transit Police is a tri-state police department, one of the only non-federal police agencies in the United States having jurisdictions in Maryland, Virginia, and the District of Columbia. The special police have limited training, aren't required to go through the Maryland state-mandated training, Department of Criminal Justice training in Virginia, and adherence to the standards in the District of Columbia, and they are sworn. They aren't always armed, but they provide a lot of service to our constituents and our facilities, but the training is not as extensive, nor are their salaries.
And how many of them do we have in the system?
Currently, we have 100, with this 17, if I'm not mistaken, 162. That we have protecting all of our facilities and our bus divisions.
Okay, because to the point that Mr. Benjamin was making on the last item, obviously there's a great opportunity in having special police officers out there from a visibility standpoint. I would be shocked to hear if a passenger really, the vast majority of passengers could even detect the difference between one or the other. And from a visibility standpoint, I would think the more of these we can deploy in our system, economically, the better, just from a visibility standpoint. And so I don't know if it is proper in this committee or not, but I think at some point in time the board should get a report on what activities special police officers are allowed to conduct and the feasibility of extending the number of special police officers in the system as an economical way to raise awareness, at least with our passengers, of police presence in our system.
Or alternatively, use special police officers to take over functions that sworn police officers are doing, but special police officers could. So if the sworn police officers are out in the system, I think it's really important to increase visibility. You have now given us three numbers, a 900,000 annual number, a 525 that you gave us orally just now, and there's a 500 in the document. Which one are we approving?
We spoke to the $525,000 because we are 4 months into the FY11.
I understand that, but you also have 500 for FY11 in the document. Is it 500, 525? I understand the difference now. But between
525 for FY11.
525, so you're going to adjust the document.
Absolutely,
before it gets
sir.
To the board. Okay.
I just have a motion from please. I move that we amend the FY11 budget to include the 17 additional special police officers.
Second.
Was there a
resolution
second?
On that?
Second.
Yes, we do.
Yeah, so you're moving the resolution.
And I, discussion. The clarification also is that we're moving overtime dollars in order to fund this. And this does not, is this all of the overtime amount that we're using? That is, this is a portion of the overtime that's being used in order for our...
And actually, let me address that. So how we're funding it is the question.
That's exactly.
And what we have done is we're funding it with savings that we have identified in our bus budget. So as a result of some of the things that we're doing in procurement, which is doing large master contracts to procure parts as well as commodity types of things that have small business compliance in them, we are actually able to renegotiate pricing that is in our best interest. And those contracts are being put in place as we speak. So when we had prepared that analysis, we had determined that we would actually save money in our bus budget. And between Jack Requa and the chief, they had decided to utilize those savings for this particular purpose. So it is within the funding of the operating budget that you approved. We're just utilizing it more optimal.
That coupled with the overtime savings.
Yes, right now the chief is actually using overtime and he's actually overextending his budget. If he continues that way, it'd be in a worse situation. So yes, you're right, it'd be overtime.
Okay, Mr. Down.
Just picking up on Mr. McKay's comment, we would put that on the agenda for a security and safety committee discussion. We'd in just one of the future months.
Mr. General Manager, information to us. Any other questions on that? All those in favor of a motion?
Aye.
Those opposed? Thank you very much. The next is the approval of two reimbursable projects, and these are projects within the jurisdictions which they're closed out, and the transfer of funding. Is there a motion, or do we need a discussion?
So moved, but I do have one correction.
Mr. Benjamin moves approval, and it's a second.
Second.
Thank you,
I'd like to move it with the correction as part of the motion.
Okay, but you have a question or a correction right here.
Okay. I think this is fine, and I particularly like the fact that all the money is being credited back and all of it is staying within Metro. However, in the second whereas, I believe you have the projects reversed.
That's correct. We'll make the change before the
okay.
coordinator.
So if you would make that change before it makes it to the board. Thank you.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Thank you very much. The next is a smart trip card price change. This was brought to the Finance Committee for discussion last week. We requested that the JCC also meet and the staff come back with additional options. Ms. Kissel.
Great. And I have Steve Holland, who was here last month discussing this, and I will have him continue the presentation based upon some of the discussions he's had with the JCC. So I think this
is okay.
Good morning. Can you go to the next page, please? Okay. So in follow-up to the last time we met, the guidance that we got from the board is here on this slide. The first thing was to focus, I'm sorry, just take a half step back. Last time we met, we went through a number of options, which were called options A through G. And the first piece of guidance was to focus on the options that have the least impact to the customer in terms of creating inconvenience for them. Number two was just sort of open-ended, feel free to develop additional options without any constraints of any of the previous items we talked about. Number three, to add an option where the card costs more than $250 but less than $5. Number four, determine whether cards can be sold with a preloaded bus pass on them. And five, get feedback from the JCC. Next slide. So based on that guidance, we came up with two additional options from the original A through G. We added what we're calling G2, which was a variation on G. And so this is the option to sell cards without any stored value, but would have a preloaded bus pass on them. And the potential proposal is that at our Metro sales offices, the five offices that we run ourselves, we could sell those types of cards there under that option. And then we added option H, which was the in-between 5 and 250, which was the cost of the card being $4 with a minimum entry of $1.10, 45 cents for senior disabled. Next slide. So we took all of those options, A through H, to the most recent JCC meeting on September 23rd. And walk them through all the details, ask for their feedback. And the options that received the most support out of all the options that we discussed today were option D, which was status quo, stay where we are with the $5 card, or option G, no $0 value sales, with the cards having at least $2.50 of stored value on them. Okay, and then sort of a deep dive on those two options. Option D, the status quo, the pros, three things that really stood out. It addresses the gaming issue, which is why what really drove the whole conversation, as well as the potential run that the gaming could cost, could create for the cards. This option doesn't require any changes to the rules, the software, or the hardware for entry or exit rules. And it retains a sales price greater than the cost of the card. So if you remember, the cost of the card, $340. The cons is that it doesn't, meet the desire to be able to lower the price for customers. And on the bottom, the chart just shows at each of the four major distribution points what we would be selling the card for, the combination of cost of card and the amount of value on it, and if we stay with the status quo. Next slide. Option G, no $0 value sales. Some similar pros, except in this case it would allow us to reduce the price of the card. It still addresses the gaming issue and potential run on the cards. Again, would not require any changes to the rules, software, or hardware for entry or exit. The cons, the price of the sales price of the card would be less than what it costs us, $250 versus $340. And if you sort of step back from it, the total outlay that the customer, money that they have to take out of their pocket, would still be at least $5. So it wouldn't be $5 for the card, but they still need to come up with $5. And the table on the bottom, again, shows the major distribution points, how we would sell it. So the rail station, dispensers, and CVS would be $2.50 for the card with $7.50 of stored value on it, whereas at the Metro sales offices and at Giants, it would be $2.50 for the card with $2.50 of stored value. Next slide. So based on that feedback from the JCC and the deep dive that we did on the pros and cons, the recommendation that the staff would like to make in the meeting today is if we would indeed want to go ahead and reduce the price of the card, then we would recommend option G because we think it's the best way to mitigate the gaming while also focusing in on the guidance that we come up with a solution that has the least impact on inconvenience to the customer, meaning that pro that we discussed where there's no changes required to the entry or exit rules, which was something the customers were sensitive about. And doesn't require any software development on our end as well. So if we were to go ahead with option G, you can see the implementation timeline. We're recommending that we would start selling cards with that arrangement on December 19th. And basically, there's just an awful lot of legwork and logistics that would need to be done between now and then in terms of getting the cards made, distributed, a lot of marketing and customer communication items, and point-of-sale changes to store systems, both for us and our partners who sell the cards.
Okay. So we started out, when we approved the budget, that we would do $250, and we were trying to address some of the customer needs. And so we've got an option that helps us address that, although the outline may be a little bit more or the same as to what they were looking at. But they'd have value, but they would not be investing in the card as much to us.
Correct.
Those are the recommendations that we have here. And the other is really just going back to where we were before.
Right, where we still are today.
Right. Mr. Giancola, and then let's move down. Mr. Giancola.
Yeah, I'm still kind of curious on why the option D is still not the preferred method, because you certainly will. I didn't see it listed on the cons for option G. Aren't there still going to be some signage changes and other kinds of staff requirements to implement this? Yet you didn't really point that out. So, I mean, why is option G better than option D, other than the fact you're reducing the price?
And I agree. It does take some changes in terms of signage and some effort in terms of swapping out inventories to reinitialize cards that were stacked for different types of protocol. But the real benefit is that, and what we heard from some of the board members, is the requirement for the customer to pay for a card that's less than $5. So we felt that actually trumped any of the staff work that we needed to do in order to get our customers the benefit, as per the direction by some of the board members.
Your comment on this is it mitigates gaming. My view is it doesn't totally do away with it.
Yeah, that's correct.
You know, I take two trips, I can basically achieve the same result as you could have achieved with one.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of depends on the perspective. I mean, today, you know, if somebody really wanted to put the effort into it, you know, they're... I think our point was that it mitigates and that it essentially keeps us at the level we are today.
Can we monitor performance on this? If in fact people are doing that, we could change our mind.
Yes, we do have the ability to see how many people go negative and whether or not they bring themselves back to positive.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Graham was next. I'm sorry, Mr. Cannon.
Well, I supported, at the time this came up, I supported the reduction in the Smart Trip costs. But with the benefit of hindsight and the information that we now have, it's apparent to me that was a flawed decision. Because had I known at the time that the actual cost of the Smart Trip card was $3.40, I would have been far less likely in the budget context that we were dealing with then, and which we're still dealing with now. I mean, we have more bad news in budget terms later in this meeting. I doubt very much whether I would have supported it. And so, you know, I think that the starting point for me is the basis upon which we made the decision. And the decision was made on an erroneous basis, a factual error. I think we were told it was $1.50, am I right?
$2.50, that's how we came up with it.
So we were seeing it as a wash at that point. But anyway, I also need to, so I'm not inclined to support D, and I'm very concerned about G as well. What are the costs associated with G?
Just in terms of the things that are in the implementation.
What are the costs?
Yeah, I don't know a specific figure. Most of it would just be in staff time and effort, really, I would say, because the cards have to be made anyway, and they have to be distributed anyway.
We would have made that change had we kept our decision as it was.
Right.
So there are no real costs other than us working out the details and the staff and letting our vendors know.
Would the cost that we factored in on the action that we asked at the time of the board be any different or more? I agree with you, the assumption, but we factored in cost of signage change, those kinds of things. So that's where we are.
The real cost is going to be the loss that we're going to have, you know, on the cards. And we'll be using the reserve that we have currently for the Smart Trip cards.
Well, what is that amount?
That cost amount is?
Blue has said about $2 million over 2 years.
Right.
So then we're spending $2 million to implement a decision which was based on the wrong facts at a time when we're facing deficits. We have an FY10 deficit of how much? $16 million in FY10? And we have a looming deficit in the tens of millions. We have to go over all that. And at this point in time, we're going to take a hit of $2 million. See, if all of this was known, I'm just speaking as one member of this board. If this was all known to me at the time I made the decision, I'm quite sure I would have been reluctant to vote in favor of it, you know, considering all of what we were dealing with at that time. So I don't know. I think the status quo is looking more and more appealing to me. Not because I would rather lower the price of the Smart Trip card, but, you know, look at what we're facing. And I know what we're facing, by the way, in the D.C. government's budget. You know, $175 million current year deficit. And so this is hardly the time to do anything other than to shepherd every one of our dollars. So I'm very concerned about this.
Mr. McKay.
There's a huge point, of course, missing from this, multiple points missing from this presentation. One of them is which our customers can benefit, not only from the amount of the card, but if you stood in the rain this morning like I did, waiting to get on a bus behind people who were depositing change into the bus, you would understand why there's a huge benefit to our customers of having people have Smart Trip cards in the first place, which was a major part of the conversation to begin with, is how do we move people to Smart Trip cards to expedite for customer convenience, people getting on and off of our system. And so, you know, to me, if there's a cost associated with doing that, we ought to do it because our customers deserve that, and we should be looking at ways to make that easier to do. My question really is, When we made fare adjustments in the last budget, we went through considerable pain in implementing those new fare structures. From an information technology standpoint, our customers went through significant pain as we had problems implementing what was obviously a complicated system. This, to me, doesn't seem overly complicated, but I'm not an IT professional, and I want to understand why we picked a date of selling the new cards of December 19th, and why we have confidence in that date, that when December 19th comes here and our customers walk up to the machines, that if we implement this change today, at least we won't have to suffer the pain of not preparing properly. There's one thing here that we're discussing is whether to make the decision, but if we do it, I want to make sure on December 19th the customers walk up to these centers to purchase these and the cards are coded properly and they work properly. How did we arrive at December 19th, and what confidence do you have at least that we can do that?
All right. Yeah, the big difference between this and the fare change, which involves the fare system itself, is that this only involves a change to the card. As I mentioned earlier, we have to make cards regardless of the value on them and what we charge for them. So that's all of that work is done outside of the fare collection system itself. So basically, there's a types of machines that we use to encode the value that's stored on the cards. So that's something that resides outside of any kind of software development process like we had to do with the fare increase. It's something that it's more, like I said, logistical issues and in terms of building up the inventory. So if you think of all the cards that are in all the machines and the rail stations and out at CVS and Giant, we have to basically duplicate that whole stock that's currently out there and then do a swap out with them, at the time that the price would change.
So we have a very detailed plan logistically of how to do that so that this date, which seems pretty arbitrary, but it's there, December 19th, that date, by the time that date comes, we're ready to go.
Yes, absolutely. Okay.
Mr. Dicker. Unfortunately, I don't think I can vote for this proposal. And largely because of what Mr. Downey said. What was the original amount that you said we would lose per month from gaming? It's in here somewhere.
We've said up to $1 million a month.
Okay, $1 million a month. This is much bigger than what Mr. Graham was saying. That's just a one-time only or the cost of the cards. In this particular case, what we're looking at is instead of $1 million a month, $500,000 a month. Because as Mr. Downey pointed out, instead of every trip gaming, it's every other trip you game the system. So we haven't really solved the problem. And I find it incredible that we keep playing around with forcing everything into the $2.50 number, which is, in fact, less than what the cards cost, but much more important, limits our options to prevent the gaming. Whereas I think your $4 option makes gaming possible, but, the most you get out of it is 10 cents. So it isn't clear to me why we aren't choosing an option that does reduce the price of the cards but prevents gaming almost completely, as opposed to one that just cuts it in half, which is what this one does. And the one place I would differ from Mr. Downey's statement is once we go down to 250, I think it's going to be really hard after we watch people game to bring it back up again. We could go to $4, and then if we can figure out a way to get down lower, that would be fine. But I think your $4 option does solve the problem, and you seem for some reason to never want to go to that one.
Madam Chair, I think the reason that they were hesitant to go above the 250 is because this board made it really clear that we wanted it to be 250 because we were told that that was the price of a card. So we, our collective hearts were in the right place. We were wrestling with an extraordinarily challenging budget, and we were trying to do something that made sense for our customers, and to try, as Mr. McKay said, to steer them towards using a Smart Trip. So it was a win-win at the time. Now we know we had erroneous information, and we're all backtracking, trying to figure out how do we address this since we made such a big deal about the 250, we really, really wanted to do this. I think that's why the staff has been working to follow our wishes. And I don't really know what the solution is at this point, because if I could, I would go back, I'd stick with the 250 if I could, because I think there are benefits to that. Although I don't like the fact that we lose all that money. I think, as Mr. Graham said it, if we had known that then, we wouldn't have made this decision, but the point is we did, and now we're trying to figure out how we address it without, and not go back on our word and our commitment. And I don't know what the solution is. You know, I'm willing to entertain hearing more about the $4, but as Mr. McKay said too, there's also benefits to the 250. So
I just want to add to your discussion the fact that when we did this, we were imposing fare increases.
Correct.
For all times of day on.
Correct.
All kinds of people at the time. And while this sounds like a very, very meager cost to people, it is a cost that we're trying to reduce on their side.
Right.
As a service, as well as a service improvement. Mr. Acosta, do you have some questions?
Oh, thank you, Ms. Chairman. I had a question about the extent of gaming on the system today. Do you have any evidence, or what is the magnitude of gaming on the system today? Because even to recall, these were maximums that you kind of put out there in terms of what's possible. But if we have a better understanding of how people behave today and the extent of that, I think they may help us make a reasonable decision.
Right. As a recent example, if we look at the
Can
month
you
of...
Just,
sure.
Thank you.
As a recent example, if we look in the month of August, there were 137,000 cards that went negative. Now, most of those people over time do pay up and bring it back, but not everybody does.
And what percentage is that? Because I assume that some people just forget to fill their cards and they go back and pull it up again once they go negative. But what is the extent of people who never refill their cards? Or
It depends on, obviously, the more time that goes by, the more people that bring it up to positive. So it's sort of depends on the time horizon that you're looking at. Let's see.
I guess to Mr. Acosta's question, over time, what did your data show you in terms of looking at that? That is, how long a particular card stayed negative and was reprogrammed to higher versus you not seeing that card again? Is it just August, or is there anything else?
I don't have the number in front of me, but I believe it was about $100,000 a year. That does not eventually get paid off. So
that isn't the loss we're talking about. We're talking about a loss of $6 million a year if we do this, according to staff numbers.
No,
I don't think we can clarify
that's
this.
Not the number that I'm...
Yeah. Well, you said it was $1 million a month,
well, we have to, well,
and this is every other trip instead of every trip.
Let's have the answer, Ms. Kissy.
Yeah. No, we believe if we do option G, that the exposure would be essentially the same as it is today, which is approximately $100,000 a year that I just mentioned.
And why is that when every other trip you can game the system the same way as you went to a very extreme end because you could game the system every trip. Now you've come up with a proposal that games the system every other trip. Why is it that one of them people are going to do and the other one they're not?
So I'm not sure where the every other trip comes from.
Okay, maybe I'm not seeing it right, or maybe Mr. Downey also is not seeing it right. But what you do is you buy a card, right, and you got $2.50 on it. You add $2.70, take a maximum trip. Okay, then now your investment is only the cost of the card. The next time you take a trip and you throw the card away. You've made the same savings as you would have in the original proposal.
Let me try to explain. On this chart at the bottom here, over 60% of our Smart Trip cards are purchased in the rail stations. In the rail stations, you are unable to get you have to pay $10 in order to get that card. You have to make that investment. You will get $2.50 for the purchase of the card and $7.50, which is the value. So the majority of those purchased cards, if they're making that $10 investment, will not be gaming the system because it's an investment that they're making up front.
Except we expect that to change. I mean, you didn't make that argument before, and you haven't really changed anything here. This is the same thing, except you can game it every other one. You didn't, when you went to the extremes of saying you can't go negative, you didn't say, well, only 60% of the people are going to buy this anyway, therefore it's not a big deal. Now suddenly you are, when all you've done is change it from every other trip to every trip?
Well, I'll just give you the quantitative analysis that how we sell cards now on the channel of distribution. So the magnitude of the loss that we're saying if we do the $250 card price with the value on it, is the risk is the same risk that we have today. That's what
it's not the same as we have today. I think that's what you're missing, is the fact that the risk is the same as what caused you to have a problem because you thought that You thought that people would game the system, except, as Mr. Downey pointed out, they game it every other trip, not every trip. And once you do that, if you said before we were going to lose $12 million a year, now we're going to lose half of that because no other thing will change. What I'll do is I'll go to Giant and buy 100 cards.
In today's world, where we charge $5 for a card, you can also do what Mr. Downey suggested. So I can take a $4.75 trip, And then the next card I'll go negative. So that scenario exists today.
Is not the piece that your data is pointing to is what you've known for the norm, mm-hmm. and that is the norm with no question of how one uses their card.
I also disagree with the analysis that we just heard, which doesn't make any sense at all. You can't do that because you can't go negative twice. You can do the 475 and you're saying then you have a quarter on it so you can get in.
Right, and take a...
But then I'd still have $5 invested in the card, so I don't come out negative. There's no way to do it today. You can make 20 cents today, but that's the best you can do. And under this version, you can make $2.70. That's the best you can do. And $2.70 was what you were using in order to say we were going to lose $1 million a month. Now you're saying, yes, there's a way to cut that in half, because you can only do it every other trip. But I don't think you've analyzed this all the way through.
Every time you go negative, if you throw out the card and you need to buy a new card, it's still going to cost you at least $5, just like it would today.
Right, right. And so today, it doesn't really work very well because the best you can make on it is 20 cents. But if you do this, you can make $2.70 every other trip. And that was the same as you could make when we had our original proposal, except you could do it every trip. So that's the only change in your proposal, is from every trip to every other trip.
You can eliminate that by making the Metro sales office value $750 and changing the Giant to $750. So now everyone has to make the investment of $10 to get a card.
Yeah, are we then doing what it was that we said we originally wanted to do?
Well, no, but you're paying $250 for the card.
I think people would rather just leave it alone.
You're paying $250 for the card, you're getting that value of the card.
That does then reduce it to once every four trips, not once every two trips.
Yeah. I guess the question that we need to focus on is, from your analysis, and I think that's what we were going back to give some measurement or baseline of how we're going to make our decision based on your analysis. And I was trying to determine, was your analysis prior to the budget period through, or is it subsequent to the budget and the challenge that you ran into? That is, so do we have an analysis that's based on what we started with, was $250? We threw in all of the other machinations after we found the problem, but based on the $250 and the recommendation that we're making, what is the analysis that shows, and how does the gaming work based upon what we know about our sales office today, how it works? So I think that's one of the pieces that I think there's a disagreement as to the analysis, but I don't think we can – I'm not ready to challenge that in the way that Mr. Benjamin has. Okay, go ahead.
It seems to me the – real issue here is how much is the embedded value in the card that you cannot recoup. And if it's below the fare at a particular ride, there will be people who will recoup it. One other question. One of the criteria for this reevaluation was the ability to embed the bus pass.
Yes.
And I see it shown, I didn't see it mentioned in the discussion. I see it shown as possible under the option G2. Is it equally possible to do under the status quo?
Yeah, the idea with putting
at sales offices.
Yeah, the idea that we discussed last time about potentially being able to buy a card for $250 with the bus pass on it was actually a red flag that we had raised, that we were concerned that somebody who wants a bus pass may not want stored value on their card. So did it make sense to have an option of having a card with no stored value but a bus pass? And I think in retrospect, as we thought through that more, we felt that red flag that we raised actually was not substantive, because as we thought through it, we realized that scenario was only relevant to somebody who, one, currently doesn't have a card and only strictly ever wants to buy a bus pass, meaning that they would never have any use for stored value, which means I never want to take a single bus ride. I never take any bus ride that has an extra fee associated with it, like an express bus or an airport bus, and I never ever ride rail. So when we thought through all of those things, we thought it's really a very, very small group that we would be targeting there, and that really wasn't necessary. And conversely, there were some cons for doing that, confusion that we could cause in the market about which cards are sold at which places, and also creating additional work on our side to have to maintain inventory of multiple products.
So to Mr. Downey's, the bus loading is still an asset part of it. Or it's
only
not
with respect to the
option, yes.
Yes.
And it's a customer issue as well as our customer desire, as well as us trying to find other media for the users.
Yeah, they would still be able to purchase the pass and put it on the card. Absolutely.
Okay. When we sent this back, we our desire was to come back with an option, and I think the point Mr. Downey just raised about the bus passes is another one of those that we thought, from a customer standpoint, how could we better serve our customers providing that? And I think you heard, you were with the Riders Advisory Council, you got input from them, and what was the comments there on that item since it's been added to this mix? On the bus pass, I know I received comments from folks regarding the opportunity of a bus pass for people, and almost a lack of equity in terms of rail and bus in terms of that.
Well, we are putting the bus passes are going on the Smart Trip card this weekend, the 17th. Yep. So that was a big issue with many of our customers, that they're unable to have that on their Smart Trip card. So I know that that's going to be a very welcome feature, we have heard. So, and we're scheduled to make that date on the 17th this weekend. So
and those are Smart Trip cards for which they've invested the $5.
Exactly. And we've heard from many of our customers, bus riders, who would like to have that weekly pass, and that's what we're scheduled to do.
Okay. Is there, yes, Mr. Ben?
I really believe, there's equities every which way, and I hear what Mr. McKay says about wanting to help. But this authority has a lot of ways in which we could help our passengers. And the fact of the matter is that we're facing a budget reality, and this was a decision based on a mistake. And so, Madam Chair, I will move that we adopt option D.
Is there a second? Hearing no seconds,
Is there another
motion?
I would prefer to reduce it to $4.
That requires so a motion to go to the
I
next.
I understand where you are, and I don't disagree.
Okay, well then I will move the option for option H. Then I thought
the D motion did not get a second. Now Mr. Graham is moving to option H, which
is
the
$4
option. Second. Is there a discussion? Okay.
Before we vote, is the staff have anything? They didn't really discuss this. Are there any significant downsides to option H?
I think we came here with H leaves us back to where we were before. Ms. Kissel?
But can I be clear about H? H actually has the option for the $4 with a minimum entry change.
Right.
I don't think we want to make the change on the entry and exit rules, and I'm assuming you just want to make the change for the cost of the Smart Trip card to $4.
No, we want to do both.
You want to do both?
Yes, because that now prevents the gaming.
Okay,
you're now at $5.20 invested under all circumstances, or $5.10. So the most you can game us for is a dime.
Technically, what are the differences? I think in technical terms, I think, because as Mr. McKay talked about, we don't want to go back through our prior experiences, right? Okay.
From a technical standpoint, option H would require us to do software development. So in regards to Mr. McKay's earlier question, it does bring us into a different realm. Where we're now making changes to the fare system, so that would we'd really need to go back and look at it, but that could add it's potentially complicated, and we have a reliance on an outside vendor to make that happen. And
so is there an additional cost?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
There's an additional cost.
But you're pushing us towards just leaving everything alone. Don't we have a minimum entry now? On paper, yes. Not on Smart Trip. Not on Smart Trip. So it's adding it to Smart Trip that would be the issue? Correct.
If I understand the recommendations that you've given us, if we wanted to go, and I think that's the concern of the motion here, status quo, that is, go back to where we started and acknowledge that it wasn't the right thing given the information that we had. It's D. Is that correct?
Correct.
And that's our cost issue taken care of. And we're saying to the customer, we wanted to do this. We wish we could, and we're not.
Madam Chair, is there a motion pending?
There is.
There is not, well...
But that was based on erroneous
information.
Yes.
There
isn't
one.
I'd like to
want to withdraw the motion?
I'm not always a big fan of the status quo, but I think, this is getting worser and worser.
Well, Mr. Graham, I think when we had our discussion last week, we did go through all of the options. And I think we asked them to come back with the narrowest perspective that we could do. And I think they've given you your narrowest for where you say you want to be versus where others would like to be. That is, would we like to say to the customers, we have found the best opportunity to provide this? May I say my view, and Mr. Graham, am I assuming you're moving H out of the...
Well,
you'd like to withdraw
that.
There's
complexities to age.
Well,
I'm not keen on that either.
Okay.
I like Mr. Downey's motion, which Mr. Downey just tabled.
I move to table the motion,
which leaves us at status quo.
Status quo. I'll second the table.
And may I make a request, Madam Chair?
There's no discussion to a table.
Oh, okay, that's
true.
You
don't want to do that, so. That is over. All those in favor? Would you speak up, please?
Can't hear you.
Can't hear you.
Yeah.
We have the resolution, but we have not implemented that yet.
But we have to dispense
it. It was approved on the June budget, yes.
That's why we're tabling, because we have to
figure out what we need to do.
We're tabling that provision.
Okay. Tabling any.
Tabling the we understand that.
So we would have to come back.
Staff has been directed to do lots of things that aren't necessarily happening.
Okay, but I still think that. Okay. But Ms. Kissel, the tabling would remove, we would still have a requirement to make an action on the resolution.
No, his table no, motion.
Okay, but
right.
But
we would eventually have to do
wouldn't
that.
Be a re- yeah. Yeah,
we would eventually have to do that.
Yes, we would have to come back and do that. Okay, the motion is to table, and well, we've discussed it or conferred. All those in favor of tabling it, the motion that would provide the change.
Aye.
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 All those in favor?
I mean,
all those opposed?
Nay.
Nay. So,
Madam Chair,
the action has tabled the prior motion. Is there another act, another discussion?
I withdrew the prior motion.
Madam Chair, may I request that staff continue to look particularly at the $4 option and see what the implications would be of doing that, explore that, and be able to come back to us so that we could, on this tabled issue, bring it back up and, in fact, have something other than $2.50, which is potentially very expensive, and $5, which gives our customers nothing?
Yes.
Thank you.
By the next meeting.
Mr. McKay?
I would just, I would ask the maker of the motion to amend to request that information by the next meeting.
I'm not even making a motion. I'm just making a request.
Okay. Well, in that case, then, is there any reason why we can't have that at the next meeting, that analysis? I mean, this issue has been pending for a long time, and there's a lot of confusion, so thank you.
I'm going to ask an additional piece of information because I think we have gone through this with a great deal of confusion at each point that we get here. There seems to be a lack of understanding of what your analysis is, and I'd like for you to bring back a much more descriptive piece of how you arrived at each of your points. Are we asking from staff that they only look at the options that, and I guess we want to go back to the original table now, and look at the options that, one, limit gaming, two, keep the price, a cost reduction, and no additional implementation that requires changes that would add additional cost to the action.
I think that's way too limiting.
Yeah. Well,
some cost gets involved in all of these.
It's a software reprogramming. There's a software reprogramming.
I'd like to know what that is. What's the cost?
Okay. And I think that information needs to go out to the board members early on because I think we are going around on this, and we're trying to adhere to what our actions were. And I guess for some, the purpose of trying to adhere is to try and meet the commitment we made when we approved this budget. And that is, once we increased costs to our customers, one place that we thought we could help was to reduce that investment. I think we need to be able to quantify in some manner what the reduction would be against what the cost would be of trying to reach the resolution that we wanted. And that's why I asked for the items there, so that we don't come back and do this again, and we may find another way to have the discussion.
But we don't want to say no cost. In other words, there can be some investment in fixing the problem.
Well, I think there was yes, I think that Mr. Graham is correct. The erroneous part was we were going to have a neutral impact, and we didn't have a neutral impact. So I guess we're at least there are some voices that want to find that we have attempted to meet part of our mandate, and if we can't get there, please give us some more very specific descriptions of your analysis so that we can understand and will not feel in disagreement over what we hear. All right.
Madam Chair.
All right.
Point of order.
Yes.
I really do need to understand what was tabled because I withdrew the H.
You withdrew
I took it, may I finish?
Yes.
I took the tabling motion to refer to the to the reduction of the $2.50. You didn't mean it that way?
I meant to withdraw what you would to well, table what you had offered. I think I was simultaneously speaking as you were. So.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of
confusion. So the
ends up in the same place. But we don't, because if we're tabling the $2.50 reduction, then there has to be a subsequent motion to take from the table,
right.
And that has to pass. And the tabling motions do have impact.
They do.
And we have passed the tabling motion, and I thought we were tabling the underlying idea of reducing the cost of this market of art from $5 to $2.50. That's what I thought we were voting on. And so I guess I'm seeking... Since I had simultaneously withdrawn my motion for H, I don't know what we tabled.
Okay. table the action on this item.
The action on this item is tabled. Okay, that's clarification.
Okay. All righty. Smart. Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. The next item is the approval for the application of the snow reimbursement funds. And this is the funds that came back from FEMA to reimburse. And the action today is to decide where we move those funds. And is there a motion or do we need a presentation?
I shall move.
Okay. Second.
Discussion. Mr. Giancola.
Yeah. We're talking about the FEMA reimbursement here.
That's correct.
Just to get everybody focused again. It still irks me that of the small amount, percentage of our total losses that we got back from FEMA, considering we are the nation's capital, you know, the federal government is the major employer, certainly downtown. And, in fact, we were closed for a week. So the real question is, you know, how did FEMA determine the eligibility of our request? And did we try to appeal it? And you know, what kind of, give me some more details on what we tried to do, because I think, you know, they got off pretty easy on this reimbursement.
Well, I'm looking around the room. I can tell you this, that we worked very closely with the district, Virginia, Northern Virginia, and Maryland when those areas declared the state of emergency for that week. We worked with those groups as they got their reimbursements very closely. So I can't give you the details of what that was, but every effort was made on behalf of the region's part to get the reimbursement from the from FEMA and the federal government. So I don't have any other details, but we can provide them to you, Mr. Giancola.
Well, you know, it's just like 10% of our total loss, but if you look at just the costs, you know, I think they probably don't look at revenue.
They did not look at revenue, I can tell you that.
They look at just costs, because I've gone through FEMA disasters and requested reimbursement. It just seems like it was very low. It's like almost less than 20% or so of what our actual costs were. And I've seen in other places around the country 70 to 80% reimbursement on costs.
I will tell you that from Metro's standpoint, we actually had account code set up the day of the snow event. And so everything was charged in terms of snow removal, you know, the work that Mr. Kubitschek's office had done in terms of, you know, safety and the rail removal of snow. So we actually had very detailed accounting ledgers of what the costs were. We were able to submit that. Why we were not given the full amount, you know, I can get back to you on that question.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Graham.
Thank you. I have a concern about this. What is our FY10 budget deficit appear to be at this point?
Well, we only have 2 months of the year.
FY10.
Oh, FY10. Oh, I apologize. It's $16.4 million.
Okay, $16.4 million. This snowstorm expense was related to what we spent in FY10.
That's correct.
To operate this system.
That's correct.
I want to ask that it be incorporated by reference all of the discussion that I've had about preventative maintenance at all of the meetings. I am not going to repeat one word of it because, quite frankly, I've had enough. But if you don't mind, I'm just going to let that go. And for those who don't know what I'm talking about, we'll talk about it offline. But here, I really would like to see this snow reimbursement, which is directly related to an expense that we had in FY10 applied to the deficit. Because, you know, and I say this to you with the utmost sincerity, that if we're going to have to find these dollars somewhere, the District of Columbia is facing a $175 million current year fiscal gap. And so if people are thinking that it's going to be as easy, and it wasn't easy, I'm not saying it was easy, but if people are thinking that it's going to be as easy as it was in years past for additional subsidies to come forward, please think again. And we're painting ourselves into a corner with this amount of money. It's admittedly only $1.76 million. I agree with Mr. Giancola that that's not very much. But it's something. And it's something that otherwise we are going to have to find somewhere in order to accommodate the FY10, not current fiscal year, FY10 budget deficit in excess of $16 million. So it would be my proposal that it is prudent at this point, particularly with those of us who you know, are directly involved in budget issues in our own jurisdictions, to reduce the FY10 budget deficit by that amount.
Any other discussion? There's a motion on the table, and I will leave it at that. This is in keeping with a resolution that was passed for our budget that if additional savings came forward, we would apply it to preventive maintenance.
Yes, that's correct. The recommendation really is based upon the board's intent or in the board's resolution that was passed to look at additional revenues and expenses that first priority would be applied to preventative maintenance. We use that basis as the criteria for this.
Thank you. And I think we're all regionally challenged with the same things, but we have at the regional level here another challenge that we articulated during that budget. Are all those in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Opposed?
No, and please record me as voting no.
Mr. Graham is recorded in voting no. Okay, the next item is the reprogramming of the capital budget policy. And this was also part of our FY12 capital budget guidelines, and it provides us the manner in which we coordinate how we're going to move forward with moving up that dollars in the capital budget, and I think it very much aligns with an information item that's coming later, that in order to make sure that the projects move quickly, that we have a mechanism. Ms. Carroll.
And you'll recall this is a presentation that we originally provided last month.
You can make it as brief as long as
I will do my best. The committee asked us to review the policy, the proposed policy with the JCC. Again, just quickly, the general manager under the previous policy had wide latitude by the way that projects were defined. And so the general manager could move money broadly between these broadly defined projects. If you could go to the next slide, please. This is a review, and I won't go into all the details, but we wanted to lay out the brand new capital funding agreement, the oversight responsibilities, and then what Metro needs to do in order to comply with the oversight that's required. There were new reporting requirements, notification to jurisdictions, and all of those are detailed here, and I won't go through the details in the interest of time, if that's all right. If we could just turn to a couple of the examples. Well, actually, prior to the examples, there's the JCC input slide. I just want to make the points that the JCC did. Can you get advanced too, please?
You're not clear, Mr. Talk to the mic.
I'm sorry. The next slide, please. Continue. All right, so the JCC input. They wanted to make sure, number one, that projects weren't canceled. And the example that was discussed in great detail is the $1 million bike and ped project. So the concern, as I heard from the JCC, is they wanted to make sure that we didn't empty out, if you will, several projects in order to add to a bus purchase. So that they wanted to make sure that policy changes were brought to the board and to the committee.
Such that the scope of a project and everything that was defined for that would be staying the same. We would not be changing that.
Right. Right. There were some that felt that reprogramming between categories should require board approval. There's some examples that I'll show later that shows how that there could be reprogramming between categories that wouldn't affect the scope of a project or policies. That was a concern that was brought up by the JCC, and we did not make a change to the proposed policy on that particular issue. I just wanted to point that out. And finally, the JCC wanted some real-world examples, and we provided three in the presentation. And we can talk about those. Next slide, please. So the very first one, and this is illustrative. There are two illustrative examples, and then the last is an actual one and is an action that the board took last month. So in this example, a line rehab project, such as the Red Line project, is moving more slowly because of track right issues. Another project in a different category, the test track, might be able to be accelerated. So this is keeping the same scope with each project. It's just a change in cash flow needs. It would be $2 million under the $5 million threshold, and under the proposed policy, the general manager would have the authority to move those funds, to spend the money on the test track, to
delay, or it would just be delayed spending because of project issues on the line rehab project, but the scope of neither project would be changed. Jurisdictions would receive advance notice because it's over $1 million, and the reprogramming would be reported to this committee in the monthly report. The next example is one, again, that we spoke about in detail. This is the bike and pedestrian facility project. In the event that the manufacturer of the bike racks was not able to produce the bike racks, and only half of the budget would be expended, but a new safety issue arose, and $500,000 was needed for that, we would have to come to the board for approval. And this is one of the concessions. This is a change that we made to the policy because of the input of the JCC. In this case, half of the budget, or over half of the budget, of the bike and ped project would be reprogrammed, and so we would come back to the board. That was the way that we tried to deal with policy issues and tried to make sure that they were brought before the board. And then the final thing we would do, the board would approve the reprogramming, and then we would adjust the next year's budget in order to pay for the delay in the bike racks. And then the final example is a reprogramming action that was approved by the board last month, and that's we had contract savings with the replacement of the southeastern bus garage of $5.7 million, and the board approved the use of those funds for system-wide infrastructure rehab projects, including parking garage upgrades. And in that example, it's over $5 million, which brought to the board approved the transfer of those funds. So those are the three examples that we provided. If you turn to the next slide, please. This is the same chart that the committee saw last month. The one change, and it's highlighted about the middle of the page, movement of funds between projects. I've just called out that movement of 50% of a project's budget requires board approval. And again, that was to try to make sure that all policy issues were brought before the board. The real purpose of the reprogramming policy is to deal with cash flow issues. We're on a cash flow budget. We're trying to move projects as quickly as possible. We're trying to not, the purpose is not to change scope, and the purpose of this policy is to make sure that any scope changes are brought to the board.
Okay. And so the recommendation?
There are two other quick things I wanted to note. Right now, the reimbursable projects budget, the general manager has the authority with the request of the jurisdiction to establish a reimbursable project budget of $200,000. I think that's been in place for some time. We thought it reasonable to increase that limit to $500,000. Again, these are funds that are provided 100% by the local jurisdictions, and that does require board notification. And finally, there's an issue of settlements. In many cases, we are reimbursed for property losses, and we wanted the ability, again, with board notification, to take those proceeds, establish a project, and so then staff could begin working on replacing or repairing the asset. Again, that would require board notification. So that finishes the presentation.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Grant.
You know, I think there have in the past been huge problems relating to the capital budget. Once again, I say incorporate all of our comments on all of that. I'm not going to repeat all of that. There have been significant improvements in recently. There's no question about that. But what's missing from this presentation for me is the justification relating to delays, the justification concerning delays relating to the time necessary for this board to act. Because there are certainly delays in the capital budget. There are delays in spending monies. There are delays in terms of proper notification and scheduling, and I know we're going to a new system and so on. But where is the justification relating to this board's involvement? Because as I said when this issue last came up, the message that I am getting from my constituency is, and it's a tricky issue because I don't want to be a micromanager, but at the same time, the message that I'm getting is that they want more meaningful involvement by this board. And so if you have a case to make where, using past examples, where this board has somehow held something up, or time has been necessary to a significant degree to review all of this, but that's just not my experience. That is not, the problems relating to the capital budget in the past have not related to this board. To the contrary, this board has done everything it could to expedite capital budget spending and reporting. So I need to know more about that before I could say I supported this.
So let me try to answer that question in a couple of different ways. One is, I know that the board, we provide to the board during the cycle of a budget year, as well as the JCC, our new CIP, our six-year capital improvement plan, with very specific projects. That process continues through the budget year, and then the board at the end of June has an opportunity to vet that. We actually vet it with the jurisdictions, and the board approves the annual projects in that annual budget within the framework of a six-year construct. That's the first step that happens, and I believe we do that. We have done that, and we do that now. That's many of the improvements that we have made. With regard to changes during the year, I think the second point maybe that you're trying to address in terms of the justification, the involvement of the board as you come through the year and the progress that you're making on the capital program, we have a later presentation that we're going to be talking about the project management of the capital program. And that project management of the capital program hopefully will give you some insight as to the board's participation, as well as the oversight, the accountability, and the transparency that we have actually started to put in place that could resolve some of the questions that the board has. So
that doesn't respond to my question.
Okay, well, I apologize. I'm trying to respond to your two areas.
I've been wanting more discretion, more power over reprogramming. Mm-hmm. I got that part. Mm-hmm. You know, why is this board, to what extent has this board contributed to the problem necessary to find this solution? That's what I'm not hearing an answer.
May I just reframe it? And that is, why should the board not be engaged in this process as this is a reprogramming and, I'm sorry, a change in programming of how we will manage the capital budget? We've given you the authority. We've given you more money. Why could you not come back to the board every time?
I'd like to.
That's better.
May I, and if I may make a try. There's a slide earlier on that talks about the structure under Metro Matters, and if you could go back to that slide, it says Metro Matters at the top. Prior to that. No, two, please. Okay, thanks. Under the previous Metro Matters agreement, project was very broadly defined. Project, the two that are listed here, were rolling stock bus and rolling stock rail. Within this structure, the general manager had enormous authority to move funds between what are called the project elements here. So the general manager had more authority to move funding under the previous reprogramming or the current reprogramming policy than he or she will have under the new policy. What we've done, and this is in the spirit of the capital funding agreement, is we have more narrowly defined the word project. And so where project was more broadly defined here, we're now defining it much more narrowly. And we're actually requiring more actions to go, I believe more actions to be brought before the board. So any movement between, in this example, $20 million could have been moved between these project elements. It was reported to the board, but it didn't require board action. Under this new policy, movement of $5 million will come before the board. So I think we're actually increasing the visibility to the board and ensuring that all policy issues are brought before the board.
Mr. Benjamin.
I'd sort of like to argue the opposite of Mr. Graham's discussion. It seems to me that a lot of what we're doing here relates to how we used to do business with an obligation budget. This is not an obligation budget. This is an expenditure budget. To operate an expenditure budget effectively, you have to have a lot of flexibility, and you have to move money back and forth between projects and between project categories, so long as, or in order to reflect the rate at which they move and what's going on. It seems to me that as long as we have, and you can go to that other slide that shows the projects that we've done, as long as we have approved a six-year budget that has a dollar number associated with a project, the interest of the board is to make sure that that number does not go up or down over 6 years, and the interest of the board is that the grand total for the current fiscal year does not go up or down. Within that constraint, all we really need to know is what is going on in those projects so that we can say, hey, how come this one is constantly being deferred? How come it's being slowed down? So we need to be informed. I don't know that we need to give prior approval so long as the project itself is not substantially changed. So as far as I'm concerned, $5 million is low. You should have unlimited capability so long as the total for a particular project does not change. So that means if you take $1 million out this year and you put $1 million back in next year, that's fine, because the project that we approved is still there, and as long as you tell us that you did it, we can say, how come this project keeps getting delayed? If, on the other hand, you increase the amount this year, that seems to me to be something that we really care about. Or if you sharply decrease the amount this year, because now you're changing the projects that are going to be done this year substantially. And if any project changes substantially, we want to know that too, because it was a reason why we approved those projects. So I would tend to go just the opposite direction and say, so long as a project, not a Metro Matters project, but a project under our current program, stays with the same number of dollars over the full 6 years that have been approved, we don't really care which year the money gets spent in, so long as we know that the project is moving at a reasonable rate and we're informed. But prior approval, I don't think matters. We've already basically given that. And so that's where I would go, really very opposite to where you are, going to give you even more flexibility.
Mr. McKay.
Yeah, I agree with what Mr. Benjamin just mentioned, but I do have a question. In the presentation, you talked about the JCC and their concern about moving funds from different categories, and you gave us one illustrative example of how you've addressed that. If we assume the JCC's recommendation was that board approval would be required to move from category to category, what would be the practical implications on staff of doing that? I mean, do we have any idea how many of those there would be? I generally agree with their concept that moving money from categories is a much bigger deal than subcategories and projects, and I just want to understand what are the practical implications if we were to approve this policy change, but where we were to require that money be, that anytime you move money from one category to another, that you get board approval, what would that logistically mean? If that was the only change we made to the staff recommendation.
It's difficult to look at the past because the structure of the program has changed so much. And so the example that we provided was the best that I could illustrate that. I think it would be something that we would have to we'd have to see throughout the current budget year. I mean, there are going to be cases where a project in one category is going to slow, the scope won't change. A project in another category is going to speed up, and the scope won't change. And we would need to prepare the board materials and bring that to the committee. I think it's just the past experience is just not relevant given the new structure of the capital program. So it's difficult.
So we really don't know. We're just, I mean, their concern sounds very legitimate, and it sounds like we really don't know the volume of occurrences under which their concern could be addressed.
And we have proposed, and actually every reprogramming action over $1 million, we need to provide advance notice to the jurisdictions. And then the other is that each reprogramming action will be reported to this committee. And so in the event that the policy needs to be changed in the future, I think that we're all committed as we move into this new phase of project implementation to monitor this capital reprogramming policy, monitor project implementation, and make adjustments as necessary to ensure that the board maintains its oversight function.
And that's the real key, I think, that everybody is concerned with. But I think we shouldn't lose sight of the other part, is that the flexibility gives us a chance to implement mm-hmm. our capital budget as quickly as possible with oversight.
Right.
Mr. Downey has a question, and is there a motion on the table yet? I think we haven't. Okay.
Go ahead
with your question then.
Yeah. It was an observation more than a question. I'll wait
okay.
for a motion.
Is there a motion?
I'll move approval of the staff recommendation.
Okay. Second.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded. Your question.
I had raised one issue last month, which has been addressed, so I'm very supportive of this. I also feel that we have more important things to be doing as a board and should be doing more of them than
small changes in the capital budget. I'd hate to load up our agendas with millions of items.
Mr. Benjamin?
Yeah, the thing, I can support this, but I feel uncomfortable because I don't think we're focusing on the right thing. We're focusing on dollars associated with projects as opposed to the total project itself. And I think what I would really like to see is a revision to this in which it says, as long as a project doesn't change over the 6 years and as long as the total doesn't change in a given year, and so, you know, so that the projects stay the same, you have unlimited ability. I don't care about categories or projects or anything else. But if you start to play with a project and we choose a percentage, you know, if X percent of a project changes and is not replaced in some other year, then you don't. There's nothing in here that says, other than the 50% of a project, which is an enormous number for a large project, there's nothing in here that says keep the projects at the same level, which is what I think is useful. And if you went in that direction, you'd practically never come back to the board.
Yeah, but you couldn't do that because that's a future promise to make good in year 5 or 6, which, you know,
yeah.
I mean, yeah, that doesn't convince me.
That change would require an amendment to the capital plan, which we would at least once a year have the opportunity to focus on.
Yes. Yeah. Every year we look at the capital plan and say, let's look at it and see where we go.
Some project has been thinned down to the point where it's dead. We might say, no, let's keep it in there.
And that would be part of the pieces that would be coming to us.
That's part of the yearly cycle. You have that opportunity now and always have. So we're presenting the first part of the next year, 6 year CIP next month. So you'll be able to see the progress that's been made, how we've reprioritized. For example, we've gotten NTSB recommendations. We will be coming forward with a reprogramming because of some safety investments that we need to make right away. So we'll be coming to the board for that decision, not doing that just individually.
Okay.
I'm wrestling with this, and I hear what others are saying, and I think there's some very compelling points that have been made. Mr. Benjamin, I appreciate your point of view on this, although we may have a philosophical.
If you'd speak up for the mic.
Yeah, I want to understand this category significance that you mentioned. You give us a chart on Metro Matters, and you give us a chart on the capital funding agreement. These categories seem very similar to me. You know, in the sense that, I mean, if you were going to say, are you saying that in the capital budget for FY11, there's a capital project, I'm just making this up, for the Columbia Heights Metro Station, and that we have identified an amount of money for that specific station? I don't think that's what's happening in that capital budget, which I have in my hand now. I don't think we get into that level of detail, so I'm not sure. There are still large categories of funding in the capital budget, which would permit, you know, the transfers that previously occurred, the reprogrammings which previously occurred under Metro Matters.
In this table, we've listed only one category. We have a slide later in the presentation that lists all the categories. The structure of the capital funding agreement now is that there's a category, and those are listed in the capital funding agreement. There's a subcategory, and in this instance, it's replacement of rail cars, replacement of buses. And then below that, at the lowest level, is the project. And I think that may be what you're referring to, Mr. Graham. In this example, it's kind of small, but there's CIP 057, 1,000 series replacement cars, CIP 060, 4,000 series replacements. If we can go to the appendix, there's a list of all the project categories. Each project in the CIP falls within one of the requirements that is in the – this is a full list of all of the categories.
And within those categories, there is the discretion to reprogram.
Up to five million between projects.
The current policy.
With the new capital funding agreement, we need some clarification, and that's one of the reasons why we brought this reprogramming policy forward. We're dealing with a policy that actually predates Metro Matters. There's new terminology that's used in the capital funding agreement, and we really need to conform it to.
What I'm trying to understand is just simply why, and there may be a very good answer to the question I have in my mind. I'm not saying that there isn't. But why, because of our change in the capital budget approach, we're suddenly going to be flooded with reprogramming requests that heretofore we were not. I see this as very similar to what we previously had insofar as reprogramming within categories.
I'm not sure if we're going to be flooded with requests. I think that the policy needs to be updated. It's over 10 years old. It doesn't reflect the expenditure-based budget that we're on now.
I think what we have here is those who wish to give greater discretion to the general manager, and I can understand that point of view. I really can. And those, such as myself, who feel that we need to maintain an engagement in terms of the capital budget, at least to the same extent as we've had previously. And, you know, it just comes down to that for me. And right now, I'd rather remain engaged and informed for a period of time until I see how this new process is working.
Let me just put a piece on the table that I've labored with this, because I personally believe that it's moving in the right direction, but I also believe that there is a point of confidence building as to how we operate that makes us be supportive. And maybe we need to streamline this action to a point of how much and over what time frame to observe how this new process is working. Because I personally am ready to support the recommendation, because I think it does give us what we're asking for. And that is, we jurisdictionally have committed, and through other sources, to a capital budget that we find to be urgently needed and to be moving quickly. And by not providing as much flexibility as possible, we could have dollars sitting around, and we've said we don't want them sitting here, and we don't need them to go back because we made a commitment. Now, how do we execute that, and how much time does it take away from implementation by the accountability that we're asking for? And we could either go one way or the other. We could ask that this is approved for a period of time and come back to the board for review. And that could give us a six-month review. And that six-month review would be able to measure how this committee has seen the information, how the jurisdictions have been engaged as was presented, and if we're all comfortable with that, we implement the policy as a permanent piece. Would that action help?
Yes.
Because I really think we continue to say we're giving more and more responsibility to the general manager, and right now we're holding our hands back a little bit because we don't know if it's going to work out in fruition. Mr. Downey?
I think I can support the idea, mm-hmm. but I would suggest a year rather than 6 months to get through a full capital budget.
Or at least through the end of this fiscal year.
Okay. And would that do in the motion that's made? And I think there may be a change that you want to make. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, as the maker of the motion, I would amend my original motion to include a one-year review. I think that's an appropriate period of time, and specifically I want to find out how the jurisdictional reporting piece of this is working, because my only concern is, you know, you could move from a project in one entire jurisdiction into another, and the way I read this is only under circumstances of over $5 million is the board actually acting on that movement. Otherwise, we're being notified. And so I want to make sure at least that provision is working to the JCC satisfaction. And I would hope that at the end of that one-year review, we would come back, we would go to the JCC, we would get their input as to how that's working, and the board would be informed as to how that process is working. So I would amend the original motion for that one-year report back by staff.
As the seconder?
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. All right.
Can we have it as a sunset?
I guess.
These things have a way of, particularly during the budget, you know, things have a way of kind of slipping through the cracks. I'd rather see an affirmative responsibility on this board to renew this policy.
At the end of the, at the beginning of, well, at the approval of the next budget.
That's right.
Is that
next
budget would be this spring. Yeah. We have a good idea about that.
It would.
I would like to get a little bit more time if we're going to do it.
But we'll have enough time to really see if it's working or not. Right. Yeah, my intention was a 12-month period of time.
The fiscal year. You said
12 months, right. but we can make it 12 months at which point this dies unless it's renewed by the board, which then does at least force a reconsideration.
Can I make a suggestion?
Yes,
because the end of the year, fiscal year is June 30th, of course. But what happens is we don't really know those expenditures and closing out of our books until really literally the 1st of September, end of August. So you'd want to give a little bit of time in order to have that closure on the year expenditures.
Well, what I wanted to ask more specifically than the time frame is the sunset clause. I mean, does that present a significant problem for the staff? It does involve the time frame because we may not know some of the impacts of this by the time it otherwise would expire. And I just don't know if we want to be in the process of reinventing every year our entire budget strategy. The point is, what's been pointed out is there's a problem spending money, and that's what we're trying to fix here. And I'm not sure that we want to sunset it and reinvent our practices every year. And is that a concern of staff's? And if so, if we did sunset this, what would that mean?
Let me make another suggestion. In the capital funding agreement, there is a requirement in October, actually today, I believe, to actually provide an initial look at the annual work plan for, you know, your capital projects and then going forward. So if we want to keep within that time frame, that would be a good look to see October 14th, I believe the date is, in the capital funding agreement. We could tie it to that as a sunset, get the feedback from the jurisdictions, because you'd have enough time to see if that's actually works. So
okay.
I would recommend that.
And I would agree with that. And
There's no disagreement on that one as a...
Just for clarification, the words in the agreement are the 10th business day in October. So I just wanted to make sure we're consistent.
Right.
Consistent with the capital agreement. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
Okay. Opposed? Okay. Thank you very much. We are now at the hour that I promised we would be finished, and we have three things. And I am going to ask the following, that we defer the operating budget guidance and that we take 1 minute, Mr. Kubitschek, to talk about the program management, and the others will be part of the discussion. Okay. Yes.
Okay. If we only got 1 minute, I'll dispense with the presentation. Okay. Basically, as I've said over the last few months, this organization, because of various changes and approach, was not set up to manage a capital program, and it presents a big challenge in this fiscal year and in ensuing fiscal years. Over the course of the last couple of months, we brought on board a consultant, Parsons Brinker of Americas, to provide us with assistance in creating an overall program management function in this organization, which eventually I would see over the years staff would really take that over. My view here is that on, say, a quarterly basis at the board's discretion, we will have PB, their senior leader, come to the board, give us a presentation on where we are, what risks we are facing in terms of implementing the capital program as laid out, what actions we should take, and give the board more engagement, really, in understanding how we're doing with the capital program, and provide staff with an ability to really integrate individual projects, which doesn't go on today. So this is not going to happen overnight, and there's laid out in the presentation a series of milestones in terms of more reports being brought forward, which will help us manage the overall program.
Thank you, Mr. Searles, and as I said, this goes very much hand in hand with the other part that we talked about. But thank you for your presentation, and I hope when we get, I think with this information and the steps that you have to take, we will get through our challenge.
30 seconds. I just want to put on the record, I have a personal service contract with Parsons Brinkerhoff for various studies that I do. It has nothing to do with Metro, and I have no financial interest in Parsons Brinkerhoff. So.
Thank you.
If I could, I'd also like to introduce Mr. Dave Donatelli. He is the number one guy with Parsons Brickerhoff. He is a regular fixture in this building in a lot of meetings throughout this area, and we're very pleased to have him and his staff aboard.
Thank you. Are there any questions regarding the monthly financial? And I guess we need to highlight just 2 points. One, budget and ridership numbers, which are very critical.
The same trend that we saw last month continues in August. For Metro Rail, we're experiencing growth, small growth over last year. It's still not as high as we had anticipated in the budget. On bus, both the average weekday and the year-to-date ridership are below budget. On Metro Bus, the fiscal year-to-date ridership is below budget by 9%. We're still seeing the effects of a slowly recovering economy. Jobs are being created. I think I saw in the newspaper it would take 9 years at the current rate of job growth to replace the jobs that have been lost. I think that's hitting some of our riders disproportionately. There are other things that we're also analyzing, such as the elimination of the paper transfers, and that could have an impact on the total number of riders, as well as the shortening of the transfer window from 3 to 2 hours. So year-to-date, with the financials, we're down by about 4% on rail revenue, 6% on bus revenue. We are at the very beginning of the fiscal year. We've just completed our first quarter actuals. We're making projections, and we will deal with the revenue shortfalls. One of the things that the general manager has tasked us with is developing $25 million of expenditure reductions as part of the FY12 budget. We are working to develop and implement those as quickly as possible so that they can take hold in the current fiscal year.
I'm going to ask that we move this item up the next time so that we don't keep ignoring it, particularly as we get prepared for the budget process.
I did want to make a quick comment. I thought in this particular version of this, there was an excellent analysis of ridership and fare issues, which clearly are a very important one, and it was very well written and very well analyzed, so thank you. Wasn't there, it seems to me that we used to have, or you had in one time, other transit systems that you could say, you know, what's happening to them versus us, and I don't think I saw that in this one.
I can include that in the next months, so that would be a comparison, because actually, and we can actually include some of the regions, which would be also of interest, some of the other bus regions.
Yeah, it can help us in saying, you know, are people riding on somebody else's bus instead of ours? Is everybody facing the same issue? What's really going on?
We have had a peek of that, and actually the region's bus ridership is declining in some areas. Some areas are not, but we can actually provide that for you next month.
Yeah, that was very good when you had it in
there. Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to have to adjourn this meeting. No other discussion. Meeting's adjourned, and the clock must be slow. Thank you for cooperating.